All right, here's some more amazing honeybee facts. Check this out. A hive of bees will fly 90,000 miles, the equivalent of three orbits around the Earth, to collect just 1 kilogram of honey. Here's another one. The bee's brain is oval in shape and only about the size of a sesame seed, yet it has remarkable capacity to learn and remember things and is able to make complex calculations on distance traveled and foraging efficiency. Hey, join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. It's called Beyond Belief, and you can get unlimited access to Beyond Belief with George Norrie. You can watch George anytime, anywhere, on your computer, iPhone, iPad. No commercials, no sponsors, and you can enjoy Beyond Belief ad-free. Just sign up and watch full episodes instantly. For more information and to sign up, visit beyondbelief.com. All right, we'll get back to my conversation with beekeeper George Scott. Plus, your questions and comments at the bottom of the hour. Stay with us. Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. George Scott stays with us, the founder of the Niagara Beeway and the website www.niagarabeeway.com. George, these bees, they're just fascinating. Now, how does a creature that has a brain the size of a sesame seed, how could it be so smart, and yet they are?
Well, now I think, you know, when you put bees in jeopardy, like we're losing them, everyone starts studying them, and we're even learning more about how fascinating these little creatures are. You know, as human beings, we think we're pretty smart. You know, we can hand down from generation to generation without being present. You can write down information, and you can die. And your two sons can pick up that information and they can understand how to build a diesel engine because you wrote it all down. You're not there, but the act of writing was a type of communication. Well, bees on every capped cell, and there are thousands of them, some have young, some have pollen, some have medicine, some have honey in it for the midwinter, some have honey for mid-spring, some have don't touch until party time. They have, every one of those cells has something different in there. And on all of those cells, there's a type of uniform bumping on there. Because remember, it's dark in there. So the bees, as they're running across those capped cells, are feeling those. That is their written language. When you pull a frame out, knock all the bees out, and put that frame of cells that are all sealed, no one knows what's in there, and you put it into a different bee colony, the bees run across it very quickly. They know where the pollen is. They know exactly what to open. They can't smell through the wax. That's a seal. But that bumping is their written language.
But sounds like Braille. Also, George, it sounds like Braille.
Like Braille. So now they have the wiggle dance. That's like sign language. The queen says it's a little bit hot in here. She releases a hormone, more ventilation. All the bees start fanning more. They communicate by hormone. They communicate by Braille. They communicate by the wiggle dance, hand signals. Not only that, they've got antenna. Well, antenna is for Wi-Fi, and we have no idea really how they're communicating at that level, but the antenna are connected to the biggest part of their brain. So they have a number of layers of ability to communicate that we're really only starting to understand. And for something with a brain the thickness of your fingernail, that cooperation, remember, they're all individuals. They're not programmed to do anything. They are making decisions to fly. They fly right, they fly left. They come back. If you stop them from going one place, they make decisions individually. They aren't a mindless throng of insects. They're all individuals who have agreed to work together, and they use their skills to do that.
Amazing. Talk to me about the social structure or the division of labor within the hive. You mentioned foragers, scouts, workers. Then you mentioned something I've never heard of before, ventilators. What do ventilators do?
Well, when you make maple syrup, we use natural gas or fire to drive off 60 gallons of water from our maple syrup, because 60 gallons of liquid makes 1 gallon of maple syrup. Well, bees don't have fire. They have to use their wings. They're really humidity control experts because they're evaporating 60 gallons of nectar, which they collect 10 milliliters at a time. Each little bee is a 10-milliliter tanker truck. They're running out and getting that nectar and bringing it back. The only way they can drive the water out of it is by fanning it. So they are very, very high-tech HVAC, heating, air conditioning experts in order to make that precious product, the honey.
And how often per second is a bee flapping its wings?
Oh, unknown. If you try to take a picture, the cell phones, which are fantastic today, are not adequate to catch the bee's wings in a frozen state. So they're really moving. I have no idea, beats per second or beats per minute, whatever it is, but it is a phenomenal rate. Many times you'll hear things like, technically, bees should not be able to fly. Their wings are too small for the weight of their body. And, you know, aerospace engineers always say, yes, bees can't fly. They're not designed to, but they do fly. And how does that happen? Well, that's an aerodynamic mystery as to how those little wings, which are paper thin, can carry that insect in wind and rain and all sorts of elements and until the day of their death.
Well, I mean, if bumblebees, definitely. I mean, look at the mass there, the size of the body compared to the size of the wings. I mean, that's a mystery. How a bumblebee manages to lift off the ground, I have no idea. So when you look, if you were to look at a ventilator bee next to a bee comb maker, next to a scout, is there any physical difference? Or I mean, how is the who decides and how is it decided what bee becomes a ventilator and what bee becomes a scout?
Well, when you look at the life cycle of bees, you see when they come out and they're brand new coming out of their cell, they are one day old, they're still a little bit wet. And what they're doing in their first job is house cleaning, because they can walk around a little bit and they can pick up some debris. So the first job is house cleaning. But as their wings start to firm up and get a little bit harder, they don't fly out to become foragers right away. They spend a day or two in the hive ventilating. So that structures their wings and makes their wings stronger and ready for flight. And during that time, as they're doing that exercise, they start to exude small little platelets underneath their legs, which are the wax platelets. So they chew that wax up, and that makes them bricklayers. So as they age, they become very specific to task. And in the latest part of their lives, they are either entrance guards or they are foragers. So as their 35-day life or 37-day life approaches its end, they're flying in and out, not only bringing things into the hive, but taking toxins and other negative items that are in the hive that build up from time to time, other dead bees, bad products, insecticides in particular. They are used to transport these things out of the hive. On your last day as a bee, and you know your wings are all beat up and you're not really going to make it back, you can bet they're loading you up with all the bad things and saying, here, go take a long flight and get these things as far away from the hive as you can.
That's cruel. That is so cold.
Well, the girls do give up their lives to protect one another. You know, it's like a love relationship. You know, when they sting, they're stinging for the hive. They're not stinging because they want to. When the honeybee stings, it's death. It's like a suicide bomber. Their bodies explode. They are making a decision for the benefit of others, not for the benefit of themselves, when they sting. They're not after you to punish you. They are giving up their lives for their sisters.
What percentage of the hive are females?
It depends on what time of year. The males are really the pride of the hive, because that's where all the genetics are. That's the only way a hive can go from one generation to the next, is through its drones or the males. And in the fall, they're not, they get a free ride all summer, free food, free grooming. All they have to do is fly out and take care of the queens as they, the virgin queens as they fly up. That is the job of a drone, to get up there and install his genetics into the new queen. And the new queen will have many drones breed with her on her flight. And as she ages, she gets to understand each one of those drones gave her a different type of bee with different characteristics. And remember, she's planning 2 weeks ahead because she may need 10,000 more foragers because she knows the cherry trees are coming. So when she plans, she's in a new hive, she needs more bricklayers. She is planning those eggs based on her forecasted requirements 2 weeks ahead because she knows the vegetation. That's why the Niagara queens are so valuable, because they know the seasons, they know the vegetation, they know what's coming. They are much more prolific at producing honey products and bee products because they're ready for it on a much more timely basis.
Long may she reign.
She'll lay a different type of egg, and it's the winter bee. Winter bees don't live 35 days. They live 137 days. So how does she know to do that? Well, she knows her own eggs. She's seen them. She balances them. You don't want to have a really smooth, high-speed, high-flying bee in the wintertime. You want to have a little hairy bee that wants to hug you all the time. Why? Because they're warmer. They're built differently. They are slightly different bees with different characteristics. And she's planning for that and putting those eggs in there with the knowledge that those bees are coming out.
And she can decide, the queen can decide whether the egg becomes a male bee or a female bee?
In many cases, the food that they feed that egg will determine whether it's going to be a male or female. So the nursing bees who take those eggs from the queen and install them and feed them and seal them up and take care of the larva can actually turn a normal egg that would be a worker, they can turn it into a new queen. Should the nursing bees and the queen attendant bees notice that she's starting to falter, perhaps a little insecticide exposure, she's not laying 2,000 eggs a day, she's only laying 150, that's a panic situation for the attendants and the nursing bees. So they will take an egg and go and hide it in a special cell somewhere where she doesn't know where it is, and they will feed it a special type of royal jelly to turn it into a new queen. So
they do this behind her back.
Oh, those girls. You know, when you put 60,000 girls in one place, you can expect some are not going to get along. They're very efficient at working together, but when they mutiny, half of them are leaving. They're saying, we're out of here, and we're going with a new girl because we don't like the way things are done here. And off they go.
Starting to sound like Game of Thrones, George. It's starting to sound like the Game of Thrones.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, if you really bore down and take their perception of it, you know, what is really happening? Who stays, who goes? How do they make that decision? Those are decisions of like and don't like.
Really? Like and don't like? So if the queen, her egg production falls back dramatically, and half the hive mutinies or leaves, is there war, or do they just let them go? And then what happens to that queen as she goes downhill? Does someone knock her off, or how does that happen?
Well, in many cases, what the girls do when they're making a new queen is they make two or three. Because, number one, they want to leave with the new queen, right? So they'll swarm out, taking the girls with them, looking for a new cavity. But then another queen will hatch, another queen egg will grow and hatch after roughly 17 days. And out comes the new queen, she'll go back, and she'll stay in the colony. So who determines, does the old queen leave or the new queen go, or how is that all sorted out? Those are decisions. Those are decisions made inside a group of individuals as to who's going to stay and who's going to go. There is no fighting. They don't lose one bee in that transaction.
Amazing. How did you learn so much about bees, George?
Well, in our family, being, you know, of Irish extraction, in our family, as far back as we can go, every generation produced one of two things, either a Roman Catholic priest or a beekeeper. In my particular case, I never heard the call from the guy up there in the clouds, so I know he never called me, and I ended up being a beekeeper. But all of those things were handed down really from generation to generation on how to appreciate bees, how to do those things. And I wish so much so that I would have paid more attention when I was 14 years old and I was learning from my uncle. Because when you're 14 years old, you know everything. And I never did listen to many of the things that guided him in his beekeeping because many of my ancestors didn't read or write. And a lot of this information was carried down in little songs and little poems about in March and May and June and July, what to do with your bees. And it was a little song that you sang as you were doing your work. And of course, at 14, I was a giant scientist and I knew everything. So the old people didn't know anything. And I wished so much I would have recorded all of that information that my ancestors were trying to hand down to me. Now it's all in the written word and you can Google just about everything. But there was a bit of a romantic thing about some of those songs, you know, a swarm in May is worth a load of hay, you know, those types of things. And when in March you change your frames, you know, all of those little tips on what to do kept you on speed with healthy beekeeping. And those were for people who had to communicate by storytelling.
Amazing. It's also amazing how our parents get smarter as we get older. How does that work?
You know, I find that so fascinating. But, you know, you're going through that yourself. You've got young boys, and very soon they're going to be carrying the old man, and that would be you, because they're going to know how everything works, and they'll help you out. And that's the way it should be. But
right.
As they mature, they'll find out that maybe there were some little pearls of wisdom that you collected during your lifetime that they've incorporated into their lives. It always happens that way.
The parents then become the child. Now, when it comes to honeybees that you keep as a beekeeper, where do they come from originally? Were they once wild bees, or did they come? Were they imported from Europe? Where did they come from?
Well, they call them the European bee. They are not a domestic or native to this North America. They were brought here. And in the service that Niagara Beeway offers, if you are a resident of Niagara, we offer a free service to remove swarms. We go in there with a registered guy, with the right equipment. We sell happy thoughts while we're there, and we make sure that the bees are recovered safely. And in that time, what's happened is we are recovering bees from a very, very broad range, from Niagara Falls, from Thorold, from Fort Erie, from Welland. And what we're finding is now our bee yards have the broadest genetic diversity because those bees escaped from European, in many cases, immigrants who came here with bees on wooden ships for the old forts, Fort Erie, you know, Fort Niagara. They had orchards here and they made their honey. And those bees escaped and they've been living in those old churches that are 200 years old. They've been living there for 150 years.
Amazing.
And that genetics
Amazing.
Now are populated in our bee yards as our young apprentices go out and recover the swarms, bring them back here and put them into a proper box, and then we notice all the little differences.
Are wild honeybees more aggressive than domesticated honeybees, if I can use that term?
I would say of the wild bees that I know, and they are all very uniquely different behavior, how they winter over, you know, honeybees store and live all winter. They'll keep that queen warm because when the bees in winter cluster together, as they eat honey, they produce two things, water vapor and heat. When a bee eats honey, that's what he makes. So they'll keep that queen warm all winter by eating honey. They've got to get rid of that water vapor, otherwise it'll drip in there and freeze in the winter. So their ventilation in winter is so critical. If you
all right, George, I've got to
dive up, they'll die.
All right, I got to jump in here. We'll take a timeout. We'll come back, open up the phone lines, questions and comments, the secret lives of bees with beekeeper George Scott, ELO, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I'll tell you what, we are learning a lot about bees. I am just enjoying this conversation with George Scott immensely. He, the founder of the Niagara Beeway, and if you want to learn more about this organization, then visit www.niagarabeeway.com. A couple of amazing facts here. Each honeybee colony has a unique odor for members' identification. Only worker bees sting, and only if they feel threatened and they die once they sting. Queens have a stinger, but they don't leave the hive to help defend it. And most importantly, it is estimated that 1,100 bee stings are required to be fatal. That's assuming, of course, you don't have an allergy. It's estimated again that 1,100 bee honeybee stings are required to be fatal. And then this warning from Albert Einstein: if the bee disappears from the surface of the earth, man would have no more than 4 years to live. Your questions and comments for beekeeper George Scott when Coast to Coast continues right after this. All right, George, are you ready to wade into some phone calls?
Absolutely. I got to tell you, though, a lightning cloud thunderstorm just rolled in over our heads here. So if we do get hit, because we are on rural hydro here and rural phone, you'll have to give me a call back just to reconnect. But it may be a short outage here if we get hit.
All right. Thanks for the warning. Let's go west of the Rockies. Joy's in Santa Cruz, California, and she's a fellow beekeeper. Hello, Joy. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi there.
And gosh.
Richard.
Richard, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was reading George's website. As a backyard beekeeper, I've done two hives and both of them failed. One because of wasps, the other one we weren't ever sure why. But what I did notice in one of my hives, and first I want to tell you the story, and then I was hoping you'd answer your question. Maybe you can help me with the answer. We had one hive that had a comb that was kind of falling out of the frame. So we put a rubber band around it, a really thick rubber band, one of those really stretchy ones,
Yes.
and kind of stuck it up in there to keep the frame and the comb together so they could rebuild the comb.
Yes.
And they did. And what I was amazed about was one day we came out to the hive, and on the little porch in the hive, we found the rubber band, and it was completely intact and had been moved onto the porch. And when we pulled out the frame, the honeycomb was completely rebuilt. And the only thing I can think of is that these bees worked out how to pull the rubber band down slowly on both sides. And they worked out a problem. So when you talk about the intelligence of these individuals, it's so spot on. They're amazing.
Absolutely. I've seen exactly the same thing. That's a foreign body in the hive, and the rubber, no doubt they are detecting it because it has a certain odor to it. And they don't like that, so they're going to do everything that they can. So you get 10 girls on one side, 10 girls on the other side, and start pulling, and then the next thing you know, it's on your deck.
That's remarkable. And they even returned it to you for the deposit.
There you go.
That is remarkable. Now, Joy said something interesting. She lost her first hive to wasps. So those are the natural enemy of the bee because they're meat eaters, right? They're predators.
That's right. They're after the larva. They will eat pollen and honey, but really what they want to do, and they are specifically equipped, they're a little bit more heavily armored. 20 or 30 yellow jackets or paper wasps can burrow right through the guards at the entrance and right up into the nursing cavity and pull the eggs and the young developing larvae out and take those away back to their wasp nest in order to feed their young. They're meat eaters. They are the enemy of the honeybee.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies, and B is in upstate New York. Hello, B. Good morning.
Hi, very interesting show. I have a question for you that I've wondered about for a few years. I would sit outside. We have a pool. Under the diving board, there were several wasp nests. And I would sit there for hours, and these wasps every so often would come and bring a pupa from their nest and lay it at my feet.
They likened you unto a goddess bee, I think.
That's what I'm wondering. No, really, but why on earth would they do that?
I have no idea. You know, when you in Niagara, when we go to respond to a Niagara resident that has a bee issue, the first thing that we do is listen, of course, to their story, and we get ourselves ready, but we ask them to take a picture of the thing that they're calling a honeybee. And more than 50% of our calls are just going to help people from stinging insects, of which there are more than 100 here that are like bee-like insects, but not honeybees. So each one is a completely different behavior, whether they bite or sting, or they collect pollen, or they are communal or individuals. Each one, you really have to look at them to say, okay, we know what we're going to expect here. Some of the wasps are very, very nasty. And although we are not wasp specialists, we do know how to help people out when they have sting incidents. Grandparents have the kids for the week. They're running around on the deck and they're getting stung. You know, what can you do? We have the suits. We can show up. We can help them. So, but you need to really understand each one of these insects has a completely different behavior because they're built to do a different job.
All right, Bee, thank you for that. Now, wasps and hornets and yellow jackets, they can sting again and again, correctly? They don't lose their stinger like a honeybee. Is that right?
Each one, of course, is different, but they don't die like the honeybee who loses actually a chunk of its body when it stings. And remember, they sting for a living. They're going after small spiders so that they can inject a little bit of venom, or they're going after a caterpillar so that they can inject that venom to not kill, but to disable. And then they bring the caterpillar or the spider back to the nest where they'll lay an egg on it, and then that develops into a new wasp or hornet.
So they get to sting and sting again. Where is the justice in that? Let's go to the wild card line. Linda is in Bloomington, Illinois. Good morning, Linda.
This is fascinating. I have a couple questions, okay? I have not seen in the last 2 years one monarch. I've seen these little tiny white ones, but no monarchs. And then the second question, we were sitting outside the other night trying to figure this out. Last couple of years, we haven't seen any lightning bugs. Scientists have never been able to figure out how these little bugs light up and flicker on and off. So do lightning bugs have a hive like bees do? Do they go back to it? Do they pollinate? What purpose does a little lightning bug serve?
Well, Linda, that's a different insect, of course, and a kind of a different range. However, we are here in Waynefleet in Niagara, and it's a very rural community, and we have the lightning bugs. And what we've noticed is that their numbers are dramatically down. And what we're thinking here is the same thing that's happening to the bees, where we spend a lot of energy trying to figure out and how to mitigate our losses. The other insects are taking such a beating these days because of the insecticide. And people like yourself are starting to notice that, saying, hey, a couple years ago I noticed that the mosquitoes were here, and now there are none. I live in a swamp, and we haven't even seen a mosquito this year.
Seriously? Wow. Now, I mean, that's amazing, and I'm trying to decide whether I'm upset about the demise of the mosquito. Of course, I should be, because, again, that's, you know, without the mosquito, everything else collapses, right? Now Einstein hit that quote I read earlier about if bees were to disappear from the face of the earth, humans would last about another 4 years. What do you think? Is that apocryphal, or is there any truth to that?
Well, I would say whatever killed the bees, we are next in line. Certainly when we look at a neurotoxin or the chlorinated nicotine and how it works on the acetylcholine esterase in between each nerve cell, Richard, that's how we work. And when you use the word sublethal, this chemical is sublethal.
Right.
It comes with another qualifier, sublethal at parts per billion. Gasoline is sublethal at these levels. You could drink that much gasoline in there and not even notice it. However, where these are active are in that parts per billion range, and that's what the problem is, really, I believe.
All right, to the wild card line we go, and Josie is in, I love saying this name, Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Sheboygan, hello. How are you, Josie?
Hi, Richard, my favorite host. I'm calling because I've been reading about this problem for quite some time. I have articles that I clipped out of magazines, and they all mention the neonic as the culprit. And it's been I think in one of the countries in Europe, I think England and maybe others, they've already banned it. This,
neonicotinoids. Yeah.
Yes, and I just feel, you know, I'm a senior citizen, and the longer I live, it just seems that we're killing this planet systematically. I mean, it just seems that everything we do, either directly or indirectly, is killing. We're like committing suicide along with all the other poor creatures that are living here on the same planet. I just don't know what to think anymore, really. And I know people are working so hard to try to find the solution to these problems that we create. I mean, it's just pure, to me, pure insanity. And I just don't know when it's going to end. It may just end when we end, like Einstein said. You know, it's just crazy. I don't know what to think or...
Well, give us some
helpless. And, that, you know, there was another chemical that came out years ago, like in 65. I wish I could, I can't remember the name, but ever since this certain chemical came out, there were breast cancers that just started happening. Like,
well, there was DDT, of course, DDT.
Yeah, that's another thing. So horrendous, right. You know.
Well, give us some good news, George. I mean,
hit it right on the head, and I think you're doing absolutely the right thing. And that's why I'm really stepping out into the public, because this is all about awareness. When people understand that, really, they are demanding this product. When you go and buy your cornflakes, and this is in there, you have demanded that from the farmer. When you are aware and you say, how much neonicotinoid, like the video that says, we want to know, it's a drop down right on our Niagara Beeway website. When those kids want to know that, what they really have determined is we are the cause, because we are not aware of this chemical in our food and in our water. We have a full water testing service that can tell anybody anywhere, if you can send us 250 milliliters of water, we can tell you what your content of neonicotinoids. There are very few companies in the world that can do that. We're in that position right now, but Josie, you're pounding right on the right door when you say, where are we going with this? Is this good for us? Let's have a look at that. That whole thing about public awareness is the answer over the long run.
Thank you, Josie. Scott is in Oskaloosa, Iowa. Good morning, Scott. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hey, good morning. It's always good to hear your show, and this guy sure knows what he's doing. Got more than I'll ever know.
That's the truth.
Okay, here in Iowa, ISU, this was back in 07. They've been working on it pretty good with other states such as Maine and Louisiana. And what it is they found that even as far as back as the 50s, it's not incest, but it's the interbreeding that's going on, and it's killing a lot of them. Now, there's chemicals and everything else. We know that. But a lot of it is, if they were humans and you looked at them as a family tree, it's just the pole. They're bred over and over again, unlike usually in the wild. Now, not all beekeepers are like that, but it is a factor, and I'd just like to see what your guest thinks of that, and God bless.
Great question, Scott. Inbreeding,
Scott,
is that a culprit?
Excellent question. The biggest value of beekeeping is its biodiversity, and that genetic diversity in the bees strengthens it, because from time to time, and weather changes, if they're all exactly the same bee and they all suffer from the same thing, you lose all your bees at one shot. Today, Niagara Beeway is working with the import control people, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They control all of our importable genetics. And what we are looking for is, we are looking to bring a new bee into Canada. And it's called a Carpathian bee. The Carpathian bees are found in Ukraine. And the Ukraine have, as a country, more bees and more beekeepers than all of the bees in total in North America. So they know more about beekeeping over there, but they've been isolated, of course, because they were communists, and you can't deal with the communists, and we couldn't trade with them, so their beekeeping was off limits for us. But their beekeeping laboratories and their quality control and all of the shipments to Germany of honey and various products are so much better controlled than our products. We have a lot to learn from them. But the biggest problem that we had is exactly as you say, when your genetics are all exactly the same and you have a problem, they all die. When we had the first elements of colony collapse disorder, we had to import bees, and the only allowable places are Chile, New Zealand, and Australia. Chile had the same problem, they couldn't ship, so we bought our bees from Australia. However, their queens know different plants, and they were getting ready for winter in May, and come October, November, when it started getting cold, they were waiting for all the plants to open, as they had for many years. So the genetics of a one monocrop type of bee, bring 5,000 hives in, those are your Australian bees, very few of them made it through the winter.
That's amazing that they have queens in Australia, because I thought Australians were becoming increasingly Republican.
Well, you got it right
on
the head.
That's a bad joke, I'm sorry. This is absolutely amazing. I have learned so much about bees tonight, George, and I commend you for all the work you're doing. Again, the website, niagarabeeway.com. And so Niagara now must be considered a world leader in beekeeping.
We're meeting with the Liberals, the new government, the federal people, to reemphasize that we are the largest beekeepers here in Canada, and we are in Niagara. And we are looking at putting up a facility whereby up to 100 kids can work in that facility. And what we want to do is protect and re-emphasize the value of honeybees here. Long-term sustainable jobs, geneticists, bee and queen rearers, equipment manufacturers, all of that type of employment is really available to us, but we don't have a bee center. Bee people at best are organized in a medieval fashion. If you read the Bees Act, you know, that's our controlling a piece of legislation that is at best medieval. The whole system needs to be an upgrade. The whole system needs to be made aware of people who can impact it. And those are you and I, Richard. Those are urban living people who are buying plants that are soil quenched in neonicotinoids or pre-treated at the nursery so there's no insects on it.
All right, George. So it's up to us, really. It's us, the consumer, that will decide when neonicotinoids are banned. George, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this immensely. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Chris Burrows, Dan Galante, Lex Lonehood, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, and here in Toronto, Scott Guest, Nathan Smith, and Jackie Lamport, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. So long for now.